Good afternoon and welcome. Thanks for joining us. I'm Tom Hall here in Studio A. Welcome to Midday. My guests today have written an important and insightful book about the fragility of our democracy and how the rule of law in America has been brought, in their words, to the precipice of collapse. It's a story of how Donald Trump and his minions distorted, diverted, and debilitated the nation's law enforcement bureaucracy, and how Mr. Trump escaped in spectacular fashion, being called to account for dozens of serious criminal and impeachable charges. It's also the story of how many voters acquiesced to the president's claims that he somehow had been victimized, a target of unwarranted weaponization of the Justice Department in the Biden administration. Rather than finding his scandals shameful and disqualifying, his legal entanglements galvanized and animated his supporters in his successful bid for re-election. And it's the story of how the Justice Department, under the direction of Attorney General Merrick Garland, failed to bring Mr. Trump to trial, to adjudicate his actions in fulminating an insurrection and stealing classified material. My guests are longtime colleagues at The Washington Post, Carol Lenig and Aaron Davis. They have won multiple Pulitzer Prizes. Lenig left The Post last August after 25 years to lead investigative reporting at MS Now, the successor to MSNBC. Their best-selling book is a sobering exemplar of excellent reporting and trenchant analysis. It's called Injustice: How Politics and Fear Vanquished America's Justice Department. Carol Lenig and Aaron Davis join me on Zoom. Welcome to you both. Carol, I want to start with you first. First, congratulations on another really, really important and just a terrific compendium of what's gone on since the first Trump administration through very recently, and excellent new reporting about it. There was some reporting that you did in August of 2024. You broke a story about Egypt's involvement in the first election of Donald Trump back in 2016. And for some reason, it seems to me that although a lot of people picked that story up, I mean, it was reprinted in other publications, it didn't get nearly the attention that I thought it deserved. But remind us what happened in that investigation into Egypt's monetary contributions to the Trump campaign.
Well, first, Tom, thank you so much for having Aaron and me on your show and for the high compliment that it is to come from you, a journalist, about the work that we've done here. The Egypt investigation, which really started a tip that Aaron had been working hard, and we teamed up to try to bring it to life in the middle of doing a book, which was no small feat. We learned some, honestly stupefying, scandalous things. One was that a CIA informant abroad had discovered and passed on to the CIA that he had information, and actually, to be fair, he had some insight as well, but some information indicating that the president of Egypt, el-Sisi, had ordered or instructed his deputies to get $10 million some way, somehow, to Donald Trump in the fall of 2016. And this instruction came very soon, around the time that Trump met privately with el-Sisi on the sidelines of the UN General Assembly in the fall of 2016 while running for re-election. You'll remember this was a tender time because Trump was refusing his family and campaign advisors' exhortations to donate, write a check essentially of his own money to finish out the campaign. Trump assumed he was going to lose. He didn't want to burn more money. And they said, look, you got a chance and you should put $10 million into this or $20 million into this campaign so we can run the TV ads up until the end of the election season. Trump did, in the end, despite resisting, write that $10 million check after meeting with el-Sisi. The FBI began a classified investigation. And after Bill Barr, the Attorney General, came on as the new Attorney General and was briefed on this case, He warned the FBI director he wanted adult supervision. He wasn't sure about the predicate for investigating this. He was worried, why did FBI agents want Donald Trump's bank records to trace whether or not the $10 million that left a bank in outside Cairo in cash, US dollars in cash, almost all the US dollars that existed in Egypt's banking system at the time. He Barr did not see the reason to go to that length. And very soon after, the FBI agents were told, you're not going to get Donald Trump's bank records.
And Aaron Davis, in the beginning of the book, Injustice, you say that Garland failed to meet the moment. We're talking about Attorney General Merrick Garland failing to meet the moment of bringing Mr. Trump to trial. Was it timidity? Was it the did they get out-lawyered by Mr. Trump's various legal teams for all of the criminal prosecutions he was facing? I mean, ultimately, with a sort of 30,000-foot view, how did Mr. Garland fail to meet the moment?
Well, again, thanks for having us. And there's a lot of ways you could begin to answer that question. But I think in the analysis that we have in the book, it is that Merrick Garland really came in and was recoiling from the way that the Justice Department had come to operate in Trump's first term. And part of that is the Egypt story. And he really wanted to set things right. He wanted to go back to a Justice Department that, where political appointees were not getting themselves involved in decision making that had not bubbled up and gone all the usual processes and where it was being decided on the facts. And he really came into office thinking that I'm going to set this right. I'm going to go back to a post-Watergate time period. He also thought, according to the reporting we have in the book, that Donald Trump was never going to recover from January 6th, that he what had happened that day had fundamentally changed the American voters' viewpoint of him. And so he wasn't thinking and didn't approach the task at hand with the idea that there was a ticking clock, that there was a time when Donald Trump was going to be resurgent. And so what they really wanted to do was to create an investigation that would stand the test of time. And as they told people in their offices, that when someday Republicans or Democrats look back at this time period and post January 6th, everybody will be able to agree that we did it the right way. And so they started with the evidence that they had on camera of rioters going into the Capitol building, the crimes that were just so obvious that day. And they thought they would build their way up and build their way up and get to the senior most decision makers, when in fact, there was never really going to be, as they found, and it took a good chunk of a year, that there was never going to be a clear connection between some of the people who went in that riot that day and all of the whole basket of things that people, Donald Trump and people around him, were doing to try to influence the election and to turn the vote against securing the election there that day on January 6th. And so there was a huge delay. We report in the book that it's 15 months, start to finish, between January 6th and when the FBI and the Department of Justice actually sign the papers and begin an investigation into people around Donald Trump for what's known as becomes known as the fake elector scheme, what ultimately becomes the thing that Jack Smith brings as part of the case and indictment against Donald Trump. And so there's a huge time period that was not utilized. And then there's also just a huge we can get into this more, but there was a lot of hesitancy both on the side of the FBI agents and others to really go directly at Donald Trump because of the way things had happened in that first Trump term. And I will add one note on the Egypt case, which is that there were two bags of cash, two bags that weighed 200 pounds, $100 US bills. And that piece of evidence was so stunning to members of people inside DOJ, prosecutors, FBI agents, that they really felt compelled to go forward and figure out if Donald Trump had taken that money. And we found in a report in the book that they were stunned and so disheartened when the investigation was ended in that first Trump term by a series of political appointees who said, we're just not going to investigate that. And they closed the investigation without any of the typical paperwork that you usually would.
And, of course, Donald Trump pardoned all of the people they did convict who had stormed the Capitol on the 6th of January. That's Aaron Davis along with Carol Lenig. They are the author of Injustice, How Politics and Fear Vanquished America's Justice Department. It's midday. I'm Tom Hall. So, Carol, you write that Garland was very conscious of the fact that the left was increasingly questioning why it was taking so long to prosecute, especially since there had been a select committee formed and they were doing very public presentations about the evidence that was out there. And the right was simply painting the Justice Department as doing the Democrats' bidding. So here's Garland, as Aaron just alluded to, you know, had a goal of rebuilding the image of the Justice Department, and he was finding that that little aspiration very tricky to actually meet. Was it so? In your view, how much of it was political? How much of it was legal? Was it, you know, as Aaron said, they were trying to, you know, start with the little fish and work up to the big fish. But the political dimension of this, it seems your reporting, you know, makes clear that it was never too far from anybody's mind over at DOJ.
You know, I love the way you asked the question, Tom, because it reminds me that there was a perfect storm in the sense that Garland, on the one hand, wanted to avoid even the whiff that he was going in a political direction with a political motivation. And so that steered his mind. He was quite a micromanager, to be honest, and it steered him away and the entire Department of Justice away from looking at Donald Trump directly. And at the same time, you had Donald Trump much later, very successfully using his social media presence, his ability to say things that were totally false and continue to trumpet them and drill them into his supporters' minds as if they were fact. Let me meet in the middle and say, Garland's idea of let's build brick upon brick up from the rioters was never going to reach the fake elector scheme, the Donald Trump legal advisors, John Eastman, Ken Cheeseborough, these people that were close to him, that were telling him this great idea of how he could block the certification. That was never going, the Oath Keepers, they were learning fairly quickly, there was no evidence to connect these two things. And as former Attorney General Eric Holder told a crowd in Texas, where we were attending a conference on journalism and book writing, his view was you kind of had to do both, walk and chew gum. You had to look at the violent riot and you had to look at the open source evidence at the same time that Donald Trump was plotting, or his aides and his campaign were plotting how to interfere in a free and fair election. And the proof is in the pudding about the way in which this investigation actually got started. We learned in our book, Injustice, what nobody had ever uncovered, which is that this investigation began at the Department of Justice January 14th, January 15th, 2020. Immediately after leaks began coming out about the January 6th committee's discovery about the fake elector probe, and that embarrassed the Department of Justice. And we have the internal emails where the lone prosecutor that was supposed to be looking at the potential connection between Donald Trump's campaign and the riot reaches out to an investigator and says, okay, we're going to start looking at this. There was no evidence from the riot probe that was the birth of that January 2022 beginning. It was, oh, wow, the January 6th committee has this, and we're facing a lot of pressure to begin to look, and we're going to look now.
Yeah, and I want to talk a lot about that tension between what the January 6th committee was finding and what the DOJ was doing. And Aaron, you write that agents and prosecutors would focus on those that they could identify as having committed a violent crime in the attack. But unless they turned up clues from the phones or financial records or something that pointed them back towards the president's campaign, the decision effectively walled off Trump and his allies from becoming subjects of an FBI probe. So that's early on in the FBI's investigation of each of the rioters at January 6th. This was a conscious decision to steer clear of the president. And as Carol said, it just, you know, finally the events caught up with them and they sort of had no choice. But they started off making sure that, you know, they weren't going to dig too deep, at least initially, into Mr. Trump.
Yeah, there's kind of two things I would want to highlight there. One is that, you know, what happened in reality about these investigations was very different than I think what the public understood was happening for a very key first year, which is that, you know, the acting U.S. attorney came out January 7th, 2021, right after, you know, there's still broken glass at the Capitol, and says, and is asked in a press conference, who are you going to investigate? And will you investigate politicians? And he says, yes. And I think as a follow-up question, will you investigate Donald Trump? And he makes it pretty clear. He doesn't use Trump's name. It says, we will go wherever the facts lead and we will follow this investigation. And it's you know, there's headlines the next day across the country. DOJ is investigating, will investigate Donald Trump regarding January 6th. And that was kind of seared in that day as this is where they're going. When in fact, we found, you know, in the weeks after that, after Biden is installed in the White House, a group of prosecutors come in and say, okay, let's pivot and begin that investigation into people around Donald Trump. And they say, no, no. And there's that same acting U.S. attorney and the then head of the Washington field office and the FBI are saying, whoa, 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 we don't have the evidence to go straight at them yet. Let's, and they discounted kind of off the bat some of the things that were said at the Ellipse and were said that day by the president. Let's go with what we know. We have plenty of real crimes here caught on camera to begin the investigation. And there's ultimately three times prior in that first year where we found that they actively decide not to investigate folks around Donald Trump. The FBI, the Washington field office and the FBI is particularly troubled by this approach, thinking that in one case where after Bob Woodward writes a book and says there's, you know, there's evidence that there was a bunch of folks in the Willard Hotel and talking about, you know, this scheme involving fake electors, this prosecutor goes back to the FBI, Tom Windham, and says, you know, let's look at this. Let's look at what happened at the Willard Hotel. And the head of the Washington field office says, I'm not going to subpoena the friggin' Willard Hotel. I don't want to know everything that happened there. What if we catch, you know, I don't want to know every guest. What if there's somebody having a tryst in there and, you know, we inadvertently snag a bunch of things that aren't involved with this investigation. And so they really did pull back from some of the things that, you know, I think in retrospect, maybe could have changed, and people inside the Department of Justice still believe could have changed the trajectory for that investigation.
Aaron Davis and Carol Lenig, their new book is called Injustice, How Politics and Fear Vanquished America's Justice Department. We'll have more with Carol Lenig and Aaron Davis on the other side of a quick break. It's Midday. I'm Tom Hall. Stay with us.
You're tuned to 88.1 WYPR.
And welcome back. It's Midday. I'm Tom Hall. By the way, coming up tomorrow on the show, the Pulitzer Prize-winning author Elizabeth Strout will talk about her latest novel. It's called Tell Me Everything, in which some of her most beloved characters from previous books, folks like Olive Kittredge, Lucy Barton, and the Burgess brothers, interact and intertwine in a beautiful peroration on love and loyalty. So Elizabeth Strout will join me tomorrow. And if you've just joined us today, my guests are Carol Lenig and Aaron Davis, two Pulitzer Prize-winning journalists and authors who've crafted a stunning account of the failure of the Merrick Garland Justice Department to hold President Trump accountable for trying to block the transfer of power when he lost the 2020 election, and how the president has dismantled the Department of Justice during both of his terms in office. Their new best-selling book is called Injustice, How Politics and Fear Vanquished America's Justice Department. Carol Lenig and Aaron Davis join me on Zoom. You're welcome to join us as well. Our number here, 410-662-8780, and our email, midday@wypr.org. So, Carol, when it comes to this tension between the January 6th Select Committee and the DOJ and their investigation, this is something, one of the many things that I learned reading your book. I didn't know this, but you say that it was highly unusual and a break in the natural order for the DOJ to follow a congressional investigation. Usually they lead in investigating, and then the Congress will follow up. I didn't realize that because I thought lots of times Congress would look into stuff and then make referrals to the Justice Department. So tell us how it usually worked and why this arrangement was so different.
Well, you're right, Tom, and we should delineate that lots of times Congress will get curious about an issue and begin investigating and make referrals, particularly if, say, someone refuses to comply with a subpoena from Congress, as Steve Bannon did, right? They'll get curious about an issue, but it is extraordinarily rare for there to be open source evidence of a federal crime and for the Department of Justice not to be the first cop on the beat. And, you know, actually that was true with Watergate. You know, at the time, a lot of people thought, oh, Congress is leading this amazing investigation. Well, the FBI was very much in the hunt and people learned that after the fact. The investigators that were hired by the January 6th committee, largely at the behest of the chief counsel, chief investigator, Tim Hafey, himself a former U.S. attorney based in Charlottesville, were former federal prosecutors. They were mid-career, seasoned, experienced people who thought this was a big deal, and they were willing to give up, you know, their very lucrative careers in some cases, their home places in some instances, to join this work. And to a person, many of them, we learned through reporting, were stunned that they were, quote unquote, the first footprints in the snow. They were the first people to interview, you know, Mark Meadows and look at his emails. And he was the former chief of staff to Donald Trump, the gatekeeper, if you will, when Donald Trump was trying to block the election victory of Joe Biden and stay in office by hook or by crook. They were the first people to interview scads of White House aides who had served Trump, some of whom were horrified by Donald Trump's, in their view, abuse of power. Another thing that was striking about this committee was it was almost like a little U.S. attorney's office, a little engine that could. And they uncovered things really rapidly about the fake elector scheme, the effort to try to give former Vice President Pence pressure and justification to reject the certification on January 6th. Usually this is a pro forma matter, you know, a ceremonial matter. But Donald Trump had some interesting lawyers who the January 6th committee investigators learned were working overtime to conjure up a legal scheme by which Pence could be pressured into not agreeing to this. There's something else, you know, that was sort of striking about these moments, which Aaron and I learned and first reported in our book, Injustice. One of them is the testimony of Cassidy Hutchinson. While her testimony ended up not being, or her account ended up not being critical to the ultimate DOJ indictment of Donald Trump for interfering in the election, her testimony was vivid and dramatic on June 28th or June 29th, 2022. I can't remember which one it is now. You know, she gave the atmospherics of being in the White House the days before January 6th and the day of Donald Trump not apparently wanting to do anything to stop a violent attack where police were being beaten with batons and bear spray and flagpoles on the Capitol and not wanting to call off the dog, so to speak. She also testified in this amazing hearing that Donald Trump knew and had been advised that Secret Service, his Secret Service, were detecting weapons in the crowd. And Trump had, according to her account, said, I don't care if they have guns, let them through the magnetometers, you know, let them come with me. I want to walk to the Capitol. All of that gave you a sense of what Donald Trump's state of mind was. And Merrick, we learned that Merrick Garland was watching this testimony, turned to a group of aides and said, "Did we know about her?" This is June 2022. And the answer that comes back from the aide is no, sir. That day, Thomas Wyndham, the fellow we've been mentioning, the only prosecutor who had originally been assigned to look at any possible role of Donald Trump's campaign in interfering in the election, that day, after Cassidy Hutchinson's testimony, Thomas Wyndham, for the first time, reaches out to Mark Meadows' lawyer asking for those records that would reveal those Cassidy Hutchinson moments. Cassidy had worked for Mark Meadows inside the White House. And the January 6th committee had had that information for, 8 months.
And Aaron, you also report that Jack Smith sort of tried to stick with Cassidy Hutchinson and the credibility of her testimony, particularly about the business of, the fisticuffs in the limo on the way back to the White House. But many people that they interviewed fiercely disputed, in your words, her accounts under oath. And prosecutors told Smith that they wouldn't want to use Hutchinson as a witness in court. And Jack Smith eventually agreed. So there was one thing for Cassidy Hutchinson to appear on television. It's another thing for her to be evaluated by the lawyers as a credible witness. And they found her ultimately not credible. Is that right?
Well, this is interesting. You're picking up on something that I have never been asked about in the book, to be honest. and it's it is one of these kind of subplots and dramas that did play out inside DOJ in those many months. Cassidy Hutchinson's testimony was, as Carol said, I think a lot of people can remember it and how vivid it was, the ketchup on the wall and things like that when Donald Trump was upset. But it also was, and I think you can lose sight of this, it was about the third or fourth different version of events that Cassidy had given to the committee. And she'd had multiple interviews with them before, but it kind of reached this point, we recount in the book where, and she said herself that she wanted to tell the committee the full story. And we don't fully know whether it's just this series of different versions and interviews that she gave that, gave prosecutors pause to put her on the stand and say, well, you've given multiple accounts about this, but there certainly was also, we do know from reporting, Jack Smith's team went back over her testimony with a fine tooth comb, went back to everybody that she named and suggested, saw some of the things that she saw. And they did not get to a place where they felt that they could put her information in the indictment and rely upon it in their case against Donald Trump. So that is it's an interesting wrinkle in all of this that, had it gone differently, had DOJ conducted the first interview and she was under oath in a investigation, would it have been a clearer, recitation of events that could have been relied upon as the first, legal deposition in that case? We just don't know, but it's a symptom of this very problem of Congress having gone first, and their aims were different than the Department of Justice, and we will never know, had they gone first, how things could have turned out differently.
The book is Injustice: How Politics and Fear Vanquished America's Justice Department. The authors are my guest, Aaron Davis and Carol Lenig. It's midday. I'm Tom Hall. So Carol, let me ask you a question. I'm almost certain you have been asked about the book. Although I haven't read or seen any interviews about the book, I've been too busy reading it and engrossed in it. The January 6th committee, Benny Thompson, the chair, and Liz Cheney, the vice chair, a Democrat and a Republican, said that they were not going to hand over any of the discoveries that they'd made to the Justice Department because it would jeopardize their fact-finding. Explain the dynamics of that. That seems to a lot of sort of lay people as, hey, look, this is all the government. You're all supposed to work together. You're supposed to cooperate. You're supposed to talk to each other. You're supposed to help. And there's this great TV show that's in fact directed by the former director of Nightline. I mean, a guy from ABC News who knew how to tell a good story, divided up into, consumable chunks, etc. Why didn't Benny Thompson and Liz Cheney want to help out the Justice Department if, in fact, their ultimate goal was to hold Mr. Trump accountable?
Great question. And I'll say that what we know from our reporting is that there was a lot of broken trust on both sides. You know, Merrick Garland's DOJ didn't want to have any contact with Congress initially in any way, shape, or form. Their Garland's operating principle was, if we start talking to Congress about these things, are we going to look like we're taking direction or coordinating in some way with a political entity or a different branch of government? And on the other side, Liz Cheney and Benny Thompson told their chief investigator, Tim Hafey, who, again, a former part of the DOJ firmament who wanted to turn over some of these interviews to DOJ, his old employer, they told him, hey, look, sorry to be so late to the party, but we have fact-finding we're doing. We don't work for the DOJ, and we're about to put on our quote-unquote, you know, final report, which is really our final ABC frontline show. And we're not going to blow our work by giving this off to the Department of Justice. There was another factor going on for Liz Cheney especially. She was very worried about witness intimidation. And so in the case of Cassidy Hutchinson, she told some of the investigators she thought this woman's life was in danger. And that was part of the reason for there being really a surprise witness, where many of the investigators on the team had no idea that Cassidy was going to testify that Monday or Tuesday, forgive me. And so there was a little bit of a tension between these two branches of government. And you could argue that the committee sort of stalled DOJ, but DOJ had already waited a year and a half before actually trying to ask and answer some of these questions.
And Aaron, there are legal consequences to this. I mean, once it gets into the courtroom, there's a guy named Matthew Graves who wanted transcripts of interviews with people in the Proud Boys, and he said if he didn't get them, he was going to have to postpone the trials of these Proud Boys guys who had been indicted for helping to organize the Capitol attack. So explain how it is that the deficit that DOJ had, not having access to information that the committee had, was going to affect in real ways and in real time the prosecutions that they were trying to assert for some of the other people involved in January 6th.
Sure, there certainly is a point where these, you know, simultaneous investigations, parallel investigations, one on the political track by Congress and, you know, this fledgling one, this criminal investigation, at least on the side of people around Donald Trump, but kind of collide, but they do so in a first, and like where there's so many of these rioter cases that are beginning to work their way towards court and trials, and this is the incoming U.S. attorney in D.C., the first one who's confirmed under Biden, and you know they're just about to go to trial with some of their first Proud Boy cases, and the Congress is about to have public testimony involving some very, you know, people with these extremist groups speaking on the record about what their motivation was and what they were doing. And they had to pause and said, you know, we had requested a delay for this trial. And it did further, you know, complicate the timeline. We report in the book, actually, that there was not a certainty until the very last day that the Congress was ever going to turn over many of the deposition records, many of the interview transcripts that were conducted, and there was 1,000 that they claimed that were ultimately done by the House Select Committee. As it happens, they put out their report just before Republicans retake control of Congress in the midterm under Biden, And it's the very last day. Prosecutors from Jack Smith's office are up on the Capitol waiting for a hard drive to be handed to them so that they can take it back and to begin to look through these and to figure out what was actually said to Congress. And there were complications, some technical that night, where it wasn't, they almost didn't receive the information. But then once they do, Jack Smith instructs his team to, in 1 week, go through and read all of it and dissect it and figure out where to go with that information. And they go off to the races with that. But there was a, to the last day that the Democrats held control of the Congress in the midterm, it was trouble.
The book is Injustice, How Politics and Fear Vanquished America's Justice Department. The authors are my guests, Carol Lenig and Aaron Davis. They are former colleagues at the Washington Post. We'll have more about this very compelling and important book after a quick break. It's midday. I'm Tom Hall. Stay with us.
You're listening to Midday on 88.1 WYPR.
And welcome back. It's Midday. I'm Tom Hall. If you've just joined us, my guests are Carol Lenig, a Pulitzer Prize-winning reporter who left the Washington Post last August to lead investigative reporting at MS Now, and another Post reporter, Aaron Davis, who's also a winner of the Pulitzer Prize. We're talking about their new book, Injustice: How Politics and Fear Vanquished America's Justice Department. As the 2024 presidential campaign unfolded, Donald Trump faced 91 felony charges in four different states. A New York jury found him guilty of 34 counts having to do with business records at the end of May that year, and all of the other charges were dismissed before the cases made it to trial. Lenig and Davis explore the many reasons that happened in a book that is full of new reporting and analysis that connects the dots between Mr. Trump's disdain for laws and norms and the timidity of prosecutors who fail to hold the president accountable. To join our conversation, we're at 410-662-8780, and our email is midday@wypr.org. Let's talk a little bit about the documents case, which went sort of simultaneously to the January 6th investigation. These are documents left by the president at Mar-a-Lago. You remind us that federal courts had lots and lots, I mean, in the hundreds of cases over the past 5 years in which there were classified documents in the wrong place. They found some in Joe Biden's garage. They found some in Mike Pence's garage. I found some in my basement. I have no idea how they got there. I mean, it just seems to happen all the time, you know. It wasn't that unusual, but the scope of Mr. Trump's collection of documents, including some that were highly, highly classified, is quite unusual. And again, it took a long time and a lot of arguing before they decided to enforce the subpoena, for example, and send agents to Mar-a-Lago to check things out, you know, in person. So, Carol, give us a little thumbnail sketch of how that unfolded. But again, there's a parallel between the timidity, the reluctance, the hesitation about following up on that, in the way that the January 6th investigation unfolded.
Yeah, there absolutely is, although it definitely takes a different shape. You know, Tom, the classified records case is one in which the Department of Justice, even before Jack Smith was appointed in November 2022, the Department of Justice views this as a slam dunk. I remember talking to Republican allies of Donald Trump's in the late summer of 2022, and they were lawyers very worried about his exposure. Part of the reason was he resisted over and over returning documents and what the DOJ learned after actually doing a surprise raid at his club in August of 2022, they learned two things. One, he had concealed from them hundreds of top secret records. and he had instructed his valet to essentially box them up and move them out of an area where his lawyer was supposed to conduct a search to comply with the subpoena from the government in May. He had instructed people to move these records so that they essentially wouldn't be found. The other thing that the government learned before Jack Smith was appointed was that Donald Trump had the kinds of records on his person that only a tiny, tiny fraction of government employees would have the permission to review. They were so sensitive, they were called SAP, Special Access Procedure, Special Access Program documents that only the president or cabinet member could grant people authority to look at. When the Assistant Attorney General for National Security goes with rubber gloves to look at sort of the fruit of that August raid, look at the documents, he goes into an FBI Washington field office, secure, compartmentalized information, a SCIF area, and he is directed to three piles of documents, and there is a fourth, which is in a special safe. And he has to read the code words on these documents on the in the safe aloud to his own lawyer at the Department of Justice to see, does he have permission to turn the page and see what that document is? And discovers, no, he doesn't. This is the most, this is the second ranking person essentially at the Department of Justice, the person in charge of protecting our classified records and doesn't have the permission to look at them. So why in the world are they at Donald Trump's semi-private club in Florida in a storage room where pastry chefs and sommeliers go to get supplies?
And we should remind folks that as you report and remind us, 23 people in a jury agreed that there was probable cause to believe that the president had engaged in 33 felony counts of mishandling classified records. He wasn't found guilty of that in court because it never got to court, but he was indicted. And Aaron, talk to us about the deliberations that went on with Merrick Garland, Jack Smith, and the folks at Department of Justice when it came to where they wanted to file this case. They made a decision ultimately to do it in Florida, which gave them a 1 in 3 chance that it would wind up on the docket of Judge Eileen Cannon. That's exactly what happened. And there were some people prior to that filing who vehemently disagreed with that decision. Tell us about that.
Yeah, well, the last page of this story has long been known publicly of what happens and how this case, gets upended in that Florida courtroom, but there was a whole lot of twists and turns and developments along the way that we were able to tell the story of in the book. And part of that really goes to this sense of where do you bring this classified documents case? And just to put an exclamation point on this, this was the case. Of all the ones that were brought by states, by even January 6th, this is the one inside the Department of Justice that prosecutors and agents believe is so clear-cut. You know, if there's going to be one case that Donald Trump is the most exposed on legally, it is these classified documents. They have the documents. They got them in at his club in Mar-a-Lago. But Jack Smith wants to do everything by the book and to be very, cross every T and dot every I. And so it commissions a study to say, should we bring this case in D.C., where kind of everybody in the Justice Department had been gearing up for it to take place, or should we bring it in Florida? And, he comes down on the side that really the heart of so much of the illegal activity that they found had taken place in Florida. The things that Carol recounted, this moving of the boxes, the moving of the boxes before they're searched by Trump's own attorneys and what seems to be hiding and moving them repeatedly. That's the crux of so much of the legal argument. And so Jack Smith makes a decision to bring the case in Florida. And as that decision begins to leak out inside of his office, some of the attorneys are flabbergasted that they're going to do that. The judges in D.C. are much more well-versed in classified documents cases. They've already got a grand jury that's been seated in D.C. and hearing this evidence. But they move and they bring it under Judge Eileen Cannon, who herself had, and there was much concern for doing that in Florida because for that very reason. Cannon was one of just a handful of judges in this district in southern Florida where this case would likely go. And they had originally thought, some of the people on Jack Smith's team had estimated that there's about a 1 in 6 chance that this case would end up in front of Cannon. Later, they actually realized that the odds are much greater than that. It's almost 1 in 3. The chances, and then that does play out just in that very way. Cannon, who had previously already said the government couldn't look at the documents that they'd gotten at Mar-a-Lago because they need to decide if this was presidential privilege or not, she again takes many steps that that are unprecedented and to the point of ultimately upending the case based on a minority opinion in the Supreme Court by Clarence Thomas. And that sets the stage for, you know, the case and Donald Trump's reelection and being able to cast these as, you know, meritless cases against him that that went nowhere.
And Carol, as we finish up in our last minute or so here, talk about the decision by the Supreme Court to grant presidential immunity. This is an argument adduced by Todd Blanche, who's now the Assistant Attorney General. And Justice John Roberts, in his decision, says the president is entitled to at least presumptive immunity from prosecution for all of his official acts. When, you know, Aaron talks about Jack Smith wanting to do it by the book got rewritten at that moment, didn't it?
It really did. And, you know, Tom, what I found so gripping about what we learned in the course of reporting on this moment, I mean, everyone has read the immunity decision or seen a summary of it and knows just how broad Justice Roberts viewed and his colleagues in the super conservative majority viewed the president's right to, you know, engage in actions without fear of being criminally prosecuted. Of course, you can't, according to the DOJ, prosecute a sitting president while he's sitting. But this went beyond that to say that even once he's gone, and if he was engaged in something that appears criminal, but it was part of his official duty, it's okay. But the striking and gripping moments that we found were as follows to me. One was that the judge and the chief judge who were preparing for this trial basically decided and knew before any of the rest of us that it was never going to happen before the election when they saw Justice Roberts and his colleagues refuse Jack Smith's request for an accelerated hearing. They had granted an accelerating hearing in a Colorado case that would allow Trump to go on the ballot, but they rejected Jack Smith's request. And another key moment is when Merrick Garland sees the opinion and reads it. These are his friends. These are people he knows very, very well. And his reaction, according to our reporting, was they know that they're wrong.
We're going to have to leave it there. This is a very, as I've said a couple of times today, important book, and I'm delighted that we've had a chance to talk about it. Carol Lenig and Aaron Davis, it's called Injustice, How Politics and Fear Vanquished America's Justice Department. Carol, thank you so much. Appreciate it.
Thank you.
And Aaron, thank you as well. Congratulations.
Appreciate it. Thank you.
And that's it for us today. Coming up tomorrow, the great novelist Elizabeth Strout joins me to talk about her latest book, Tell Me Everything, and Fresh Air is up next now after the news at the top of the hour. I'm Tom Hall. Thanks for joining us. Have a great day.